The content here is for informational purposes only, should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security, and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any A16Z fund. For more details, please see a16z.com/disclosures.
Welcome to the A16Z podcast. I'm Michael Copeland. After the smartphone, what business has the global scale in terms of people and profits that make it attractive for tech companies to turn their attention and capital towards? The answer, according to A16Z's Benedict Devins, is the car business. Yes, Benedict is our mobile expert, and sure, cars are mobile, but what does your iPhone have to do with your ride? More than you might expect, Evans says. Evans offers his vision of the future of cars and perhaps the future of today's biggest technology companies. Who will build these cars, who will own them, and who, or what, will do the driving in this segment of the A16Z podcast. Benedict, welcome.
Hello.
Let's talk about what cars and mobile have to do with each other, what cars and the smartphone industry have to do with each other, and what even brought this subject to mind for you.
Well, what brought it to mind is that Apple and Google are getting into the car business, and Tesla is in the car business as a technology company, and Uber is in the car business as well, and obviously we have an investment in Lyft as well. And so cars and technology are sort of colliding in a way that mobile phones and technology collided 7 or 8 years ago, and you know other things have collided in the past. And it struck me there's kind of maybe four separate building blocks to think about that kind of link together and sort of support each other. One is electric cars. One is the rise of on-demand services. One is the rise, potentially, of sort of autonomous self-driving cars, which kind of come out of both of those things and sort of feed into both of those things. And then one, which is perhaps slightly shorter term, is sort of the software in the car and how that becomes something that isn't made by the car company anymore, perhaps, and becomes something that gets into the smartphone ecosystem. And all of those kind of interact with each other.
Well, let's take those in turn then and start with the electric car and how that's sort of lends itself to technology and a technology play a la Tesla and others.
Well, the thing that is sort of most obvious and visible that people think about here is the environment and renewable energy and pollution and so on. I think equally interesting from a technology and engineering point of view is that you change the mechanical complexity of the vehicle when you go to electric instead of internal combustion engines. And you change it, and so you don't have a transmission, you don't have a gearbox, you don't have all those moving parts anymore. And so that changes potentially things like maintenance, but it also changes kind of the complexity of creating the thing, and it changes what the supply chain might look like, it changes what the capital structure of making cars might look like. And so a little bit like what happened with PCs or smartphones 10 years and 20 years ago, you move to a point that it may be easier for people who are not in the car business to be in the car business because the amount of stuff that you have to make, how that stuff gets made, how the value chain around that looks, gets much, much, much simpler.
Right. Obviously, Tesla is the best example of this, but the question then becomes, where does the value in a electric car lie? And for Tesla, it's clearly in the battery, for example.
Yeah, it's the battery instead of the engine. Clearly, but there's a sort of a longer term point, which is, well, okay, so who owns these things and how do they move around, which is where things like on-demand and self-driving cars come in. And of course, you can have those completely independently of electric cars. It just makes it a bit easier right. For some things, but you could have a self-driving petrol diesel car or steam-powered car if you wanted to. And I think those are kind of separate but linked together. And the thing with on-demand is, you know, it's sort of widely discussed now, is that you're going to reach an equilibrium point of the supply of drivers that gets drawn in by the price and the price that will drive in riders and the number of riders that get drawn in. And that will be some percentage of people in each city, and it will be different in each city, depending on the on the layout of the city.
This calculus between owning versus just...
Between owning and versus owning a car versus just calling a car, right, versus leaving your car at home, and whether you commute with it or only use it the weekends, or you know, whether you have one family car instead of two, and all of those kind of things. It's going to change car ownership. It's not going to change it completely, right, but it will change it, and it will change it kind of different degrees in different places. Now, what's interesting about self-driving cars is how much they change that. And so just as Tesla, as electric cars are not just about pollution, self-driving cars, I think, are not just about accidents. And I think the way to think about that is kind of imagine your scenario. You go out with your family to dinner in a busy city, and instead of having to find a parking space, your car drops you off. And so you don't think you and previously you might have taken public transport because it was so hard to park, but now your car can just drop you off. And there are no cars parked on either side of the road, so there's twice as much room for traffic, of course. And then when your car's dropped you off, where does it go? Does it drive outside the city centre to a cheap car park instead of the expensive car park around the corner? Or does it spend the next 2 hours driving people around for money and then pick you up later? So the point is, what self-driving does is it transforms the layout of the city, because things like parking and gas stations and strip malls and the kind of the whole layout of the retail and commercial real estate starts to change, because it's all built around parking as much as it's built around driving. You have to kind of look at a kind of a satellite map of any American city and look at all the parking space. And so that all starts to reshape. But then the ownership changes, because you suddenly have vastly more cars available for an on-demand service. And those cars don't have a driver, and the insurance is probably costs half as much, because self-driving cars don't have accidents in the same way, and the error rate will be lower. And so the price of those on-demand services will be lower. And so the equilibrium point changes again. And then you have all sorts of, and so, you know, the point is that self-driving cars, therefore, make on-demand services much, much, much bigger. And they tend to result, therefore, in many fewer people owning a car.
Question then, like, who owns these self-driving cars? Is it sort of the Airbnb model where I'm at dinner and I, you know, send my car out to make money while I'm eating? Or is it this fleet kind of a view of the world where some other large organization, whether that's Google or somebody else, owns these cars?
Well, again, this is kind of a question of where the equilibrium points settle down. So on the one hand, you could argue, well, everybody will have a car and they'll all drive people around, so there will be no like fleet of independent cars. It will just be a person's car. I don't think one would go that far. But the other argument would be, well, why would you need to own one if there were all of these out there? And of course, if everybody said that, then someone would have to buy a fleet of cars to service that. So there's a cycle in there somewhere. Now, the challenge in here is, if there is a fleet of on-demand self-driving cars, who buys them and how do they get bought? Well, right now, is it going to be an individual person who takes out a lease and sends their car out to earn money? It's obviously not going to be the driver, because there is no driver. So is it owned by an individual, or is it owned by somebody with a big balance sheet, buys 500 of them and has the right financial structure for doing that? And once you – and you that could be both on-demand and on-demand self-driving. Mm-hmm. And once you go there, well, how is it that those cars are getting chosen? They're not getting chosen based on how nice it feels when you slam the door and, you know, the diamond-cut chamfered edges. They're getting bought in the same way that Hertz buys cars, and they're getting bought in the same way that a big company buys PCs. That is to say, they're bought on, you know, criteria that are not much to do with ease of use or flair.
it's beigey and boring, yeah.
Yeah, well, not completely beige, but, you know, how easy it is to open the case and change the network card or whatever it is that you need to do these days. So, and so that becomes interesting for Apple and potentially for Tesla, because it means that, you know, if the people riding around are not the people choosing these things, then maybe Apple's strengths don't really get to come into play, because you might not be choosing it. Now, obviously, there's kind of variation within that. So you pull out your phone and you order the cheap one or the expensive one or the Apple, or, you know, maybe you get a choice of cars when you pull out when you order it. But on the other hand, if you order like an Uber black car, you don't decide whether it's going to be a Mercury or whether it's going to be a Lincoln or a Cadillac or a Mercedes. You just order that and what comes, comes. So maybe we will see. Then there's kind of another point, which is to do with the redesign of cars, of course, which is if you remove, obviously electric changes the design, but if you remove the mechanical controls, the manual controls, then you can sort of fundamentally redesign what the inside of a car might look like and how it might be structured. I mean, right now, when you look at a Tesla, you wouldn't be able to tell that it doesn't got a petrol engine inside it if you didn't know. You know, it's still got a big engine compartment in the front. There's just no engine in it. And so when you go to electric and self-driving, you can kind of think quite fundamentally about how you design a car. You might also think about things like crash tests. Like if there's no manual, if the accident rate changes or the accidents look different, then the way you design the car might change as well.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine, again, like it, changing the space and the layout. I mean, it's really an interesting problem or opportunity.
Yeah,
really.
I mean, people don't need to face forward.
Right.
And you
right.
don't need to have all that space in the front for the dashboard. And
right. Tired at the end of the day, you know, you're lying down in the car.
Yeah, exactly. And we won't take that conversation any further.
Yes.
But you get all kinds of sort of second order effects. So, you know, I think Carl Sagan said that it was easy to predict mass ownership of cars, but hard to predict Walmart.
Right. So what do you see then? You've already described empty streets, but
yeah, you look at photos of the world from the 1930s and all the street of your own city from the 1930s, and you'll see all those streets where you know there's a car parked every 5 feet all the way along the road, and there's no cars parked, right. And the roads are twice as wide. The other thing that someone mentioned to me on Twitter was cycling. Is if you could cycle every day and know you would not get hit by accident. I mean, if you fall over, then it's your fault, but you would know that no one would hit you. Through carelessness, maybe more people would cycle. If you had no manually driven cars on the road, then you don't need stoplights anymore, and the cars can just stream through all the junctions, staggering before and behind each other.
That the first time that happens, and you as a passenger go through that, there's a video that you have on your blog post, which everyone should watch. But it's a frightening game of Frogger where nothing gets killed.
Yeah, exactly. It's like watching a circus act or something. It's like people whizzing past each other at 40 miles an hour, 5 feet apart, right. And, you know, right, crossing each other at right angles. And of course, if it's all moved into software, then you can do that. So you get all kinds of changes in how you lay out roads and how you would lay out, you know, cities and what you would think about what retail would look like. Cycling, I think, is interesting. The impact on people's time is interesting because, you know, presuming for the, you know, apart from anything else, you might live in different places in the very long term, like on a kind of a multi-decade view. But in the meantime, if you're driving for 20 minutes every day, but you're not having to look at the wheel, then what are you doing? Well, you're probably on your smartphone, which is right. Cool. So the time spent online or time spent looking at the internet changes.
Because nobody's doing that now.
Nobody at all does that. But on the other hand, what happens to radio? If half of all radio listening is happening when people are driving, well, if you could be doing other things, maybe you might not listen to radio. So, you know, you get all these kind of weird, kind of unpredictable effects as kind of the balls bounce around on the snooker table, on the pool table, and kind of bang into each other. And then you also, of course, there's a sort of the big question is what happens to public transport and where does that leave people on low incomes? Because if you're cherry-picking people off public transport routes, then you're going to have buses that are emptier and emptier, and the cost of those buses becomes harder to support. On the other hand, self-driving cars get very, very cheap. How cheap? If you are someone on a low income and you're commuting to work on public transport and it takes you an hour and a half and four buses, well, maybe a self-driving car might actually be a better option for you. It might even cost the same. You know, you don't really know. So there's certainly kind of questions in all kinds of different directions.
But there's also nothing configured. There's nothing then to prevent self-driving buses and all, or sort of, you know, a fleet of transportation being owned by government for that.
Yeah, but I don't think so. I mean, self-driving, I mean, yes, not having a driver in the bus means it could participate in these kind of high-speed junctions and things. I don't think a self-driving bus is kind of transformative in the way that a self-driving car is, because there's always going to be,
right.
You know, that's, you know, the space taken up by the driver isn't really the point. But no, what I was more thinking is, you know, if you live somewhere that's served adequately by a bus but not terribly well, if you've got to walk 10 minutes to get to the bus stop or 20 minutes to get to the bus stop, then you might never take a bus again.
Mm-hmm. Right, I see.
And so the bus routes, as when you get out of dense urban areas, might empty out to some extent. Bus routes in dense urban areas might fill up because they might be more efficient because you don't get traffic jams anymore. So you can get on the bus and it goes all the way down that busy street without stopping and then lets you off where you want to go. So you get all, once you, I suppose, the kind of conceptual thing that one's looking at here is really shifting road transport from being sort of circuit switched in a sense. It's not a perfect sense, but really kind of being circuit switched to packet switched, or certainly moving public transport, integrating public transport with cars into a packet switch model.
Well, let's push on that circuit versus packet example, and because that then gets to who's best suited to be doing this. And so when you say circuits, it's sort of this manual, I'm driving, I'm, you know...
Yeah, I mean, it's not a perfect analogy. Maybe you could argue it's like it's TDMA in effect, where everyone's kind of got their time slot, and you move to wideband CDMA. Like, why would you have lanes on the highway anymore?
Right.
Why would you not just have kind of swarms of cars streaming down the highway without stopping, positioned in any place that you like on the road, just as long as there's 5 feet between them or 2 feet between them, depending on what you want to do. You could start having pelotons of cars, so you've got 15 cars all going down the highway 2 feet behind each other. At 150 miles an hour,
it sounds like NASCAR.
So who is it? Who is it? Yeah, exactly.
And so then
round and round. So who is it that builds it? Well, yeah. So this is the again. I mentioned kind of one sense in which this is potentially challenging for Apple, in that it's who is it that's buying these things? But there's another point, which is what's the hard part of the software here? There is a hard part in the not hitting things in actually the car itself. But then there is all the kind of the routing and the load balancing and the optimization and the pre-positioning of all the cars. Because it's one thing to get into your Uber or Lyft or your GetTaxi or whatever, and to summon one and the nearest one comes to you. It's another one at kind of 5 in the morning, all of those 150 or 500 or 1,000 automated self-driving cars leave their charging stations. Where should they be at 7 o'clock in the morning when people start summoning them?
Right.
Where should they be at 7:30? Where should they be at 11:06? And where do you move them? And which car do you send to take which person to which route? And what do they do on the way? And where do they go after that? And so that kind of mass positioning of hundreds or thousands of tens of thousands of vehicles in a city becomes an interesting challenge. Now, it may be that there will be some transformative breakthrough in self-driving cars, and that's the easy part, and the routing is hard. It may well be that the routing is the hard part over time. But it's just kind of worth sort of thinking, you know, yes, the not hitting things is hard, but what is it that's going to fundamentally shape what's going on in a city? It's probably going to be the routing, the apps, the kind of that broader
mapping
sort of
mesh, and data
that
sort
broader
of thing,
system.
Yeah.
Of course, this is why maps. One of the reasons why maps have become so kind of strategic.
And this is also we talked about this in the last pod, but that those three German car companies just spent a huge amount of money on
Nokia had spent on it.
Well, yeah, they got
they spent a lot of money on maps. Yeah. And one layer to that is that having maps now is a kind of strategic asset, where it used to be kind of an accessory in the way that your CD player was an accessory, and you would happily like have a Bosch CD player in your car, and BMW didn't really mind that they weren't making a CD player. Today, it's more important in the future. If the map is actually telling the car where to go, then it becomes much more important. Because clearly there's all kinds of interim steps here. It's a bit like, you know, steamships that have masts and sails for the first 20 years, just in case. And so, you know, the first self-driving car is not going to be part of a mesh of every car in the city. You're going to get into the car and say, I want to go here, and it will have to work out how to get there.
Right. Right.
And so it will have to have its own map and its own route. Yeah. 50 years in the future, it may not. To the extent that anyone has the faintest idea what's going to be happening in 50 years' time.
If it happens, if we shift from sort of circuits to packets, if we shift to electric cars, if we shift to this sort of software-driven thing, does it get on the same kind of refresh? Do we replace our cars every 2 years? Do we, you know, get upgrades every month? I mean, does it become like our smartphones, do you think?
Well, you know, someone posted a picture of their Tesla dashboard saying, do you want to upgrade to ludicrous speed for $10,000, which is kind of quite a chunky in-app purchase. You don't really get that in Candy Crush.
Right. But it's the same idea, right?
Well, it's an interesting sort of thing in here that when a car becomes electric, it becomes software. And so your upgrades, you know, instead of paying an extra $5,000 for the sports gearbox, there is no gearbox. So what do you do as a car company? Do you just say, well, we'll just kind of flip a switch somewhere in the software and we'll make it the sports one, and that will be an extra $5,000? Do they then mail you a badge that you can stick on the back to show everybody that you bought the sports one? Is there like a little screen on the back that says, he spent $10,000, it's sports mode now?
Right.
It's like that app that there was an app in the early days of the App Store that cost $5,000 and it just said, I am rich. Maybe that's what people will do with their cars. But it's almost like you're overclocking the car. You know, it's like you buy a software application and you have to upgrade it with a purchase. But the stuff is, the code is all there.
Right.
It's the same with a car. You know?
Well, okay. So you bring up overclocking, and the argument on the other side will be that people love their cars and people love to drive. And people, you know, love the smell and the sound of a internal combustion engine.
Some people do.
Okay.
Some people do, and some of those people will still keep a car, maybe. People loved horses, too. People really loved horses. I mean, way more people loved horses than loved cars.
Horses are easy to love. That's true.
And yet, there's a sort of interesting analogy here because, of course, one of the fundamental advantages of cars over horses a century ago was that you have to feed a horse all the time. And so just having the horse of itself was costing you money all the time. Whereas, never mind, you know, keeping it warm and groomed and the vet and the blacksmith and everything else. Whereas you put a car in a garage and forget about it for 6 months and it's still there.
Right.
And there's a sort of an interesting analog here as you go to a self-driving car. Well, you don't need a driver anymore.
How far out are we? I mean, we hear from Google, we know that there's rumors and kind of little tidbits of Apple hiring Tesla engineers, etc. But what stands in the way from this picture that you paint?
Well, I don't think there's anything structural that stands in the way of Apple making a car, a electric car, that's manually driven. That's just like time and money and effort. Making a self-driving car, we do not yet have the technology to make self-driving cars. Google is working on it. Tesla is probably working on it, for all we know. Uber may well be working on it. Apple, if they have, will certainly be working on it. How far they've gone, whether they plan for that to be the car or whether they will make a manually driven one first, I don't know. But there's kind of, as I said at the beginning, these are kind of multiple separate blocks here. You can have an electric car can change quite a lot without being self-driving or on-demand. You know, you can have on-demand services that change a lot without self-driving. But then when you have, and you can have on-demand and self-driving without electric, for that matter, although probably not very much. But when you have all of that in place at the same time, you know, your self-driving, I mean, back to electric, it's a lot easier for your self-driving car to charge itself with an electric socket than putting gasoline into it.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier and a lot safer. You know, I wouldn't be entirely comfortable having a robot arm putting gasoline into a car. Electricity is kind of okay.
Yes, that seems very elaborate, too, to make that happen.
It's a little bit safer. So when you put all of these things together, that's really when all of it changes.
So we've talked about how Apple and Google and others, Uber, et cetera, may be getting into this sort of car business themselves, but is it a good business? And why would you want to, really?
Well, I think there's several answers to that. One of them is that I wrote a piece a while ago saying kind of the smartphone is the new sun, and the smartphone is the dominant, it's the biggest thing in the tech industry. There are close to 2 billion phones sold every year. Those are converting to smartphones. It's $300 or $400 billion in revenue every year, and that's much bigger than they're making TVs or making PCs, or certainly much bigger than making watches or any other kind of technology, consumer technology product. Bigger than the smartwatch or the iPad or anything else will be. So the smartphone is kind of the sun that dominates that. But then you think, okay, well, what else is there? Is there anything else that is as big as a smartphone? This is this thing that is going to be owned by 4 billion people on Earth and replaced every 2 years. Is there something else that has that kind of scale? And there's toothbrushes and there's shoes and then there's cars. So if you then look at cars, you have this industry that has much higher revenue, over $1 trillion in annual revenue from making and selling cars. But the unit sales, of course, are much, much, much lower because the average price is tens of thousands of dollars.
Much, much higher, yeah.
Exactly. And so if you add up Mercedes, BMW, Audi, Lexus combined, you get to 5 or 6 million units a year for over $200 billion. Which is almost as big, which is kind of almost kind of the same ballpark as the iPhone, because the iPhone is, I think, $150 billion a year
right.
in the last 12 months. And so it's kind of an interesting one here, because on the one hand, you have this enormous industry, much bigger than anything in tech. Coincidentally, mobile network operators' revenue is about $1.2 trillion as well. So cars and mobile networks are about the same size, but much bigger than anything in tech. But on the other hand, if you added up Mercedes and BMW, you would get to maybe the same revenue as the iPhone. And less profit.
Right. And I was going to say that I'm sure there are some cars in the auto world that have the margin of an iPhone, but they certainly aren't made by Toyota.
No, exactly. That's not where the where the money is. So, and obviously, kind of, you know, you have smaller companies like Porsche and so on that make decent profits. And so, you know, mobile phones are, if you're Apple, mobile phones are a great business, so great gross margin business. Cars have low gross margins. Of course, nobody other than Apple is making any money at all in the phone business, so it's kind of an imperfect comparison to make. But it's just kind of, it's intriguing to me just to kind of think, well, what other thing is there after phones? Obviously, there'll be another tech product after phones, mm-hmm. whether that's augmented reality maybe, or folding screens or something, or, you know, contact lenses. But what other thing is there that's as big? Because here is tech that just kind of eats up other industries. But, you know, Google by itself this year probably will have the same revenue as the newspaper industry, the same ad revenue as the newspaper industry. Mm-hmm. The entire global advertising industry is only $500 billion.
Wow. Yeah, that puts it in perspective, yeah.
So, and half of that's a third of that is TV, and a third of that is internet, and a third of that is kind of other. So, like, there aren't many other things that are kind of as big as phones. And cars are one of them. And so when you combine that with all the stuff that I've said why kind of cars are going to become more of a technology product and are going to change a lot in the next few decades, that's kind of why it becomes interesting.
Does it break down along similar lines? I know, you know, you've made arguments for why maybe Apple and its kind of rarefied product lineup isn't well suited to an on-demand car world where we don't own our own cars. But, I mean, is there going to be an iOS version of the car, this high-end kind of Apple-y, you know, high-margin thing, and then the Android version where, you know, you can pay as little as you want or
well,
as much as you want?
Well, it's an interesting one. You know, what will the car world look like in when this transition has happened in, say, 20 or 30 years? You know, what will be the distribution of luxury, high-end, mid-range, low-end sports cars, supercars, limousines, and so on? What will that look like? What new kinds of vehicle will get created? You know, there will be new vehicles created in the same way that, like, the people carrier has been created in our lifetime, or, you know, the pickup truck became this mass-market consumer product in our lifetimes. There will be new types of car that get created. One suspicion is that Apple will like the high-end because it tends to like not making compromises on product to hit prices beyond a certain point.
Right.
And one suspicion is that Apple won't make a $10,000 car. One would wonder what happens to car prices as we move to electric and as we move to self-driving, and what happens to the price of owning a car if it's self-driving, it never has an accident, the insurance is a third of the cost, you're only paying for electricity. So, you know, the question is what's a high-end car kind of changes, because a high-end car might be cheaper. But yeah, these are all kind of unknown questions as to how this stuff will shake out.
Well, I look forward to the day. Honestly, as a person who drives an electric car, not a Tesla, a Fiat, I'm looking for battery technology to get better. I'm looking for the software to get a hell of a lot better. And Lord knows I would like to not drive. So
you're using Italian software.
Well, made in Detroit, though. Yes.
Which is worse.
Yeah. Believe me, there's the only thing that goes wrong with my car is the software. So I welcome the day that you describe, and hopefully sooner rather than later. Benedict, thank you.
Thank you.